the director of the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism, and it's a huge pleasure for me this evening to welcome all of you and to welcome our chair and our speakers for this event, which is part of Arts Week 2021. A part of what makes it a special event, as far as the Institute is concerned, is that it's not only hosted by us, but co-hosted with Arts Weeks and the London Renaissance Seminar. And we're here to hear about and to discuss Jews, the Reformation, and making Europe. In a moment, I'll pass over to Sue Wiseman, who's Professor of 17th Century Literature here at Birkbeck, who will be our chair for this evening. We'll then hear from our three stellar speakers, and then there'll be time for a discussion and chat. If you do have questions, please place them in the chat function, and Sue will relay your questions to the speakers and to the rest of us. And please try to keep yourselves on mute. And without any further words from me, I'll pass over to Sue Wiseman. Sue.
Good evening and welcome to this event. I'm delighted. We're here to talk about this wonderful book, which I'm sure you can't see, which is The Jews and the Reformation, published by Kenneth Austin. And he is here to speak, and he'll be joined by Helen Parrish from the University of Reading, who is an expert in the Reformation, superstition, and the relationship between the natural and the supernatural, and by Anthony Bale from Birkbeck, who's written on a wide range of topics in medieval literature, history, and culture. The running order will be as follows. First of all, Professor Austin will speak for a few minutes. Then Helen Parrish will speak, then Anthony Bale, and then we go back to the author of the book to solve the enigmatic question, what is the Reformation? Why are we so worried about it? And why were they so cross with each other? And after that, we will be able to come to your questions, which we're asking you please to put in the chat, and I will read them out at the end. So you can put them in the chat on the way through, but there are so many of us here, please just try to stay muted on the way through, put the questions in the chat, I'll read them out at the end, and our speakers will respond to them. Thank you so much for coming. I'm absolutely delighted to begin by handing over to our author and first speaker, who will also have the last word. When he's spoken again, we will be able to come to the discussion. He will start us off, two speakers in the middle. Professor Austin, over to you. Thank you so much for coming and for your wonderful book.
Thanks, Sue, very much for that very kind welcome. Thank you to you and to David for allowing me to come and speak at this event. I'm really grateful for the opportunity, and I should say in advance to Helen and Anthony, I'm really grateful that they've agreed to participate in this, and really grateful that they took the time to read the book as well. And finally, to say thank you to all of you for giving up your time to come and listen to this this event this evening. I'm really most appreciative to you all. But yes, I think sort of the what we thought might be quite helpful, given that sort of the vast majority of you won't know anything about this this book, is if I sort of try and put it a little bit of context by way of starting us off, thinking both about why I wrote the book and also what I was trying to do in writing it. And I just want to take a few minutes to think about those two questions. So the reasons for writing first. And of course, there were lots of reasons why I wrote it, but perhaps three that I want to highlight now. So the first stems is really, this is a long interest that I've had in religious boundaries in the early modern period, both between different groups of Christians, but also between Christians and non-Christians. And in particular, I think I've long been interested in the more positive interactions between those on different sides. When we think of the Reformation, and as Sue in her introduction was kind of suggesting, it probably is to the religious divisions, the polemical disputes, the military conflicts that we immediately think about. And of course, those were critical to it. But I think also one of the things that's really interested me all the way through my time thinking about the Reformation have been those people that have in some ways found means of crossing those boundaries or communicating around them, for instance. And so that led into my PhD, which became my first book on one individual, Emmanuel Tremellius, who was an Italian Jew who ultimately converted to Calvinism and enjoyed a successful career in Christian circles as a professor of Hebrew and Bible translator. So that's sort of one, at least one example of interaction, at least of a sort. And I think sort of, as I tried to talk about in relation to him, he then sort of encourages much of the interest in Jewish materials and furthers that in the Reformation era. But a second motivating factor was the desire to do something on a bigger scale. Writing about one individual worked well for a PhD and then a focus book, but it did become quite tedious. Whenever I explained what I was working on, the almost universal response was, who? And sort of this book is then sort of an intention, sort of an aim to kind of move to a much broader canvas, to something that actually speaks to a sort of a theme that runs, in my view, throughout the Reformation era. And indeed, I suppose I'm trying to say something about the Reformation as a movement in its entirety. And third, I think I increasingly realized that felt there was something of a gap in the market, as it were. I taught a couple of master's units at Bristol, one on Jews and Judaism in medieval and early modern Europe, and then a later one on minority groups, more broadly considered, in that same context. But while I always felt that there were lots of accessible books on Jewish-Christian relations for the medieval period, when one came to the Reformation era, that wasn't really the case. So in part in writing this book, it's partly sort of inspired by teaching in the first place, this is the sort of book that I would have liked to be able to point students to and to try and map out some of these big questions. When it comes to the main aims, again, I think I'll just draw attention to three by way of a starting point, at least. First, I suppose I was keen to decenter Luther, by which I mean, I suppose that I wanted to stop Luther, Martin Luther, the German reformer, being the main, or indeed sometimes even the only focus of discussions on this topic. Of course, I do appreciate the irony that any attempt to explain this process necessarily puts Luther straight back into the center of what I'm saying. But in Reformation historiography as a whole, there's been a gradual process of challenging Luther's central position. But that's not been so apparent when it comes to thinking about Christian attitudes towards the Jews in this period. In many standard accounts, from both Christian and Jewish perspectives, though for different reasons, it's quite common only to consider Luther, or perhaps at best to add in Calvin's viewpoint, John Calvin, French reformer. And in a sense, that's quite understandable. Luther was the Protestant reformer that wrote most extensively about Jews, and his later strongly anti-Jewish writings have cast a long shadow through to the 20th century. But the problem is that Luther can then come to be seen as a spokesman for the Reformation movement as a whole. And I wanted to try and suggest by casting my net rather more widely that actually Reformation figures held many more different perspectives. And in some ways, fortunately, I suppose, Luther was at sort of an extreme end of a spectrum. And sort of not even other Lutherans necessarily agreed with him, but certainly when one looks at sort of other religious movements, there was a wider range of views in evidence. Secondly, I was keen, as I've hinted at already, to operate on quite a large canvas. So geographically, I am trying to cover much of Western Europe, and chronologically between the late 15th and the late 17th centuries. And then within that, trying to bring together a range of different themes that are often treated quite separately. So sometimes sort of historians will look at the writings of the reformers in a vacuum almost, whereas I was keen to sort of put them in their context and then to think about their impact on secular policies. What do political rulers do, but also what impact do they have at the local level? To what extent do they change how what it's like to be a Christian or a Jew in those territories? I also sort of wanted to bring in something that I think is often overlooked, and that is the renewed attention to Jewish scholarship, the Hebrew language, and so on. That often is treated as almost as a sort of an entirely distinct subject. And actually, for me, it kind of, in some ways, it almost went to the center of what the Reformation was really about. And I think that then feeds into my third main aim, which is ultimately to argue that Jews were quite critical to the process by which reformers, both Protestant and Catholic, initiated reform in this era. And here, I think it's maybe helpful to distinguish between Jews of the past, present, and future, because Christians were thinking about the Jews who, at least in some parts of the continent, lived alongside them. But they also reflected on the role that they had played in the past as God's chosen people. And again, at least some speculated on the role that they would play in the future, when Christians hoped that Jews would convert to Christianity as one of the signs of the millennium, or the initiating the last days, the final stage as set out in Revelation. And sort of in these various different ways, then Jews served, I think, as a constant reference point for the various groups of Christians during the Reformation era, as they tried to work out how to be the best Christian that they could be. But whether or not I've achieved these aims, I guess we'll soon find out and see what Anthony and Helen have made of it. So I will stop my initial bit there.
Thank you so much, Kenneth, for starting us off. And I think we're going to move now to Helen, who is going to tell us a few more thoughts and give us her views on what the Reformation was, in fact, what the Reformation was and the place of Jews in it. So thank you, Helen, over to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think the invitation to participate in this session is very much appreciated, not least because an hour spent in the company of Kenneth and Anthony and others discussing the Jews and the Reformation is bound to be time well spent. When I read the book, I think my sense of its astonishing achievement sat at the forefront. And what stood out for me on a first read was the grace and ease with which Kenneth has synthesized the current state of research on Jewish-Christian relations between the 14th and the 17th century. And in some respects, it's a book that wears its learning lightly. But in order to do that, it requires the kind of mastery of scholarship, the ability to identify and to fill the gaps, and the intellectual creativity to weave just such a compelling picture and analysis from a diverse and potentially challenging set of materials. As Sue said at the beginning, I'm not so much a historian of Judaism, Jewish culture, and anti-Semitism. My interests sit in the history of the Reformation, of religion and belief in 16th and 17th century Europe. So broadly understood to include the history of the Christian churches, popular religious culture, but also the theologies, the disciplines, the perceptions that characterized interactions and relationships between between different communities and cultures. So in that sense, for me, Kenneth's book offered a new route across a fairly familiar territory. For historians of Judaism, the book perhaps presents a much needed perspective on the complex intersections between Christians and Jews in this particular period. This is a book that exploits the history of the Reformation to write a history of Jews, but also uses the history of Jews in Europe to fashion a rather different history of the Reformation. I think that the point is well made that the relationship with Judaism might have been fundamental to Christianity from its inception, but it's a relationship that was demonstrably ambivalent throughout the patristic and the medieval periods and through into the period that we're looking at today. And the tension within that relationship, as Kenneth points out, resided in the challenge presented by Jews as both the chosen people of God, going back to Augustine's recognition, but also as a constant reminder of the less than complete success of Christian evangelism across the centuries. And that reminder becomes all the more potent as a pastoral and as a polemical weapon at the points in history where, as in the age of the Reformation, religious certainties are fractured, political social contexts are subject to rapid change. And as Kenneth just said, humanity increasingly appeared to be living at the end of time. So how that tension has described has been a question of some debate, and it's a debate that's summarised with care in the introduction to the book. For those of you who've looked at it, this will be familiar territory for others. Kenneth argues, I think convincingly, that we might do better to think in this period in terms of anti-Judaism, because the obvious alternative, anti-Semitism, is a somewhat anachronistic borrowing of language from the 19th century. It's associated with race rather than with belief. Gavin Langmuir's rather different distinction is between anti-Judaism that's rational, that's inherent to Christianity. He argues it's an understandable resentment on the part of Christians that Jews had not come to share their beliefs. Whereas anti-Semitism is irrational, is informed by a set of beliefs and accusations of the type made by Christians against their neighbours, quite often in the High Middle Ages, that defy any kind of logical thought and explanation. When I'm teaching this kind of material with my undergraduates in Reading, into that category of sort of tall tales that are told, the energetic accusations that are made, come the kinds of stories of infanticide and of host desecration that were commonly levelled against the Jews in German-speaking territories and beyond, and were used to justify persecution and expulsion. So in 1370 in Brussels, for example, such claims led to the execution, to the burning of around 20 Jews and their expulsion from the territory. And both the accusation and the trial then become a part of the local calendar, that sort of cycle of annual celebrations, long celebrated in a special feast and depicted in the walls of the church. So what's interesting to me here, and it's something that Kenneth picks up on later in the book, in his discussion of the fault lines, is the extent to which this kind of rhetoric was challenged by the Reformation, but also survived it. In the 13th century, these accusations of host desecration, infanticide, perhaps acquired an almost catechetical instructional purpose. They were a visual demonstration of the doctrine of transubstantiation. In the 16th century, as alternative theologies of the Eucharist were proposed, how potent was that traditional rhetoric going to be? In the hands of Catholic writers, as Kenneth points out, attacking the Jews on this kind of basis and using this kind of language could readily become part of a response to the Protestant Reformation, albeit tempered by a desire to rein in some of the more colourful miracle narratives. So there's some really interesting work in the book on that repetition of language and of style, but directed to a different purpose. I think there's probably a discussion we can have here about that recycling of accusations of sacrilege, infanticide, and depravity as the identity of the defined enemy, the defined other, and how that changed over time. One of the striking aspects of Kenneth's work is the inbuilt determination to move the study of early modern Jewish-Christian relationships out of the long shadow cast by the Augustinian canon, come religious reformer Martin Luther. And if that's what Kenneth set out to do, as he was saying earlier, I think he's certainly accomplished that. In no small part, that shadow is created by Luther's 1543 treatise on the Jews and their lies. This was Luther in his most violent polemical form, describing Jews as miserable and accursed people, as mad dogs, capable of enticing Christians into their abominable blasphemy and other vices. But the tone and content here is not the same as that in Luther's early outputs, from which Catholicism emerged as the root cause of Christian failure to convert the Jews. Neither was such polemic the creation of Luther alone, and Kenneth reminds us quite energetically and successfully that that process of separation and alienation between Jews and Christians dates back centuries into the first century. It's solidified in those accusations of ritual murder, of host desecration, of plague spreading, and an understanding of that long and tortuous history is a critical part of any analysis of the impact of the Reformation. I think this might also lead us into an appreciation of Kenneth's commendation of the usage reformations, plural, rather than reformation, singular, as a better reflection of the multiple processes and forms of religious change that took place in this period. If we understand the fragmentation of the Christian consensus in the 16th and 17th centuries, we better understand why it was that the Reformations created a climate in which these debates over the relationship between Judaism and Christianity flourished. The different dimensions of religious reformations inform an appreciation of the multidimensionality of Christian-Jewish relationships. Going back to the book in chapter 3, Dashed Hopes, we get a fine example of the necessity of seeing the story of the Jews and the Reformation as much more than a story of the Jews and Luther. We see religious and social radicalism shaping debates over Hebrew language and learning, and accusations of Judaizing, and the sharpening of Christian attitudes towards the Jews as the product of that sort of whirlpool of Christian diversity. So what was the legacy for Christian-Jewish relations in this intense conflict that's ignited by the religious pluralism of a divided Christendom? The breadth and the depth of reflection and analysis in this point, I think, is one of the most obvious strengths of Kenneth's work. And the argument and the impact of it for me revolve probably around five key points. Perhaps most obviously, first of all, without the unity in time and in space that was provided by what Thomas More described as the common core of Christendom, Jews were no longer the most dangerous and the only other, the only enemy. If anything, doctrinal pluralism within the Christian church reduced the pressure on some of its old enemies, who were perhaps less visible than those who espoused alternative forms of Christianity. The second point, the assertion that scripture alone, sola scriptura, was the ultimate source of authority within the Protestant traditions gave an additional impetus to the search for normative truth in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. Princes who championed religious reformation in their lands appropriated the imagery of Old Testament kings like David and Josiah to support their actions. And the Psalms became a polemical and a pedagogic feature of Protestant and particularly Reformed post-Reformation culture. And I think that much would be apparent to those of us for whom this is part and parcel of studying the Reformation. But Kenneth gives us a much needed nudge into thinking about this as something that has consequences for Christian relationships with Jews. A knowledge of Hebrew texts necessitated a much more active engagement with Jewish scholarship and helped to Big Brit build at least some intellectual bridges across the divide. But these were not uncontentious. As a third point, I think doctrinal and devotional disagreements within and beyond Lutheranism created a new set of problems. The Israelites, as the chosen persecuted people of God, were fashioned into the historical bedfellows of many radical and reformed Protestants. As a result, allegations of Judaizing became a polemical weapon in confessional conflict within Christianity. This intersection, as Kenneth was saying, of past and present and future in the characterization of Jews during the Reformation, became increasingly important as possession of history became part of building confessional identities. And this section of the book was a fascinating read. Fourthly, Protestantism, particularly Protestant providentialism, fueled the sense that God was an interventionist deity who interfered actively in the affairs of the world. So religious division, the context in which it thrived, lent a sense of real urgency to the anxiety that these increasing manifestations of usually God's anger were a sign that the end of time was imminent. Conversion and the conversion of the Jews was, as Kenneth said, a hallmark of the last days. But for the work of conversion to succeed, it first had to encounter its target. And I think this was one of these moments where I suddenly sat up in my chair and thought, yeah, when Kenneth explains that certainly in the case of mid-17th century England, actually the requirement to have Jews to convert is almost being used in support of the readmission of Jews to England after a gap of several centuries. And finally, this is not just a book about Protestantism. Kenneth's analysis ranges over the diverse form and substance of the Roman Catholics' stance on the Jews, the Tridentine response, the Inquisition, and the context that's provided by political and economic pressures. And I think his work makes a compelling case for the need for historians to engage with the similarities and with the differences that were inherent of different inherent in different models of the Christian church. So where does this leave us? And I'm probably now abusing not putting these in the chat, but just chucking them out into the room. Some questions that I think the Jews and the Reformation invite us to ask. For me, I think the list would include, I suppose as a first one, there is a sense of permanence and impermanence to the presence of Jews in Christian Europe. Rhetoric seems to be the product of the repeated collision of past and present. But I'm sort of thinking aloud, I'm wondering what guides the reaction. How does an inhabitant of Christian Europe reconcile the ideas, the rhetoric, the polemic, with the reality of their lived experience? As a second point, I wonder to what extent Jews are feared, not because of who they are or because of what they represent, but because of what they tell Christians about themselves. Is it less dangerous, perhaps, to be a visible enemy that everyone can see than it is to be an invisible enemy in which we see ourselves? As a third point, as was, how tenable is the already weakened narrative of the Reformation as a factor in progress and modernization and in the emergence of toleration, given what we know and what we learn from Kenneth's work about Reformation attitudes to the Jews? Those of us who are familiar with some of his earlier work, and it's the material that Kenneth was talking about at the beginning on Emmanuel Tremelius and Irenicism, might understand why I'm asking that question about the relationship between all this and the move towards toleration. The anti-Judaism of the age was predictably of more consequence and import to the Jewish community than the precise details of the conflicts that were unfolding within the Christian church. The Reformation, we learned from Kenneth, was observed, but not with an enormous amount of comment. So Kenneth's book is shining a spotlight primarily on early modern Christian responses to Jews, rather than a discussion of Christianity within the Jewish community. I'm not suggesting that that creates an unjustifiable one-sided feel to the analysis. I think it's entirely to be expected. Kenneth, it's clear that, what he's not writing is a majority history, but a historian has to be guided by the sources and by what's available. Whether there's an alternative, a different way of, looking at these questions, perhaps we can think about. And as a, final point, thinking about some of the more recent global approaches to the history of early modern religion and indeed to a lot of historical writing, is there a history of the Jews and the Reformation that we can extend beyond Europe? But I'll silence myself there and, hand over to Anthony.
Great. Thank you so much, Helen. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And thanks, Kenneth, for the wonderful book. I should apologize that I've got a very naughty, unruly cat who's trying to get in front of my computer. So if there's a some disruptance, it's the cat doing that. Kenneth's given us this excellent new book called The Jews and the Reformation, but it's actually about more than that, even more than that. It's about the history of anti-Judaism combined with the history of the Christian church as a whole institution. And it's also a book about the forging of Europe, the making of Europe and the false construction of Europe or the self-construction of Europe as a Christian polity. So I think one of the real achievements of this book is to help us think outside the traditional confines of Jewish history or the history of anti-Semitism, and instead I think about how center and margin and majority and minority coexisted and continue to exist in step with each other. So I think it really is a book which connects a lot of different topics and a lot of different historiographies very effectively and very elegantly. So I've been asked to provide a few reflections and perspectives on issues raised by Kenneth's book. And my background is as a medievalist, and I've done a lot of work on Christian images of Judaism in England in particular. So I approached this topic thinking about the continuities and discontinuities between medieval Europe, medieval in inverted commas, and Reformation Europe or Reformation Europe's and the Jewish experience. And in order to bring some of these issues into focus, I want to give a little example from my own recent work, an example I think that Kenneth's book can help us better understand. So I've recently been doing some work on an English man named Andrew Board, B-O-O-R-D-E, who was born in England in the 1490s. And as a young man, in about 1515, Andrew Board was admitted to the Carthusian Monastery in London at Smithfield. And he was a precocious monk. He was about 26 when he became the Bishop of Chichester. But a year or two later, he was accused of breaking his vows of celibacy and of being intimate with women, and was dismissed from his post by the Pope in 1521. And throughout the 1520s, he drifted further and further from his monastic life, from his monastic calling. And Board's life can be read a little bit like a kind of individual miniature English Reformation. By 1530, he'd been released from all his obligations to the church in Rome, and he started to travel very widely abroad to train as a doctor, as a physician. And he visited Orléans, Poitiers, Toulouse, Wittenberg, Rome, various university centers, learning from medical men. But these were also in many cases centers of religious controversy, debate, and printing. And Board became close to Thomas Cromwell and the court of Henry VIII. And in 1535, Board was sent overseas by the court to see what the reaction was to Henry's divorce. Around this time, Board started to practice medicine in Glasgow, writing regularly to Cromwell with information about the Scots, whom he didn't like. And in about 1537 or 1538, so exactly at that moment of the dissolution of the monasteries in England, Board left for Jerusalem and undertook a long kind of pilgrimage stroke grand tour via Venice and Naples and Rome, finally setting in Montpellier, where he wrote several medical textbooks about how to live healthily. At the same time, he published a book called The Introduction to Knowledge, which is a fascinating text. And the Introduction to Knowledge is his observations on a clockwise tour of Europe, beginning at Calais, and going via kind of Norway and Poland and Greece, and ending in Jerusalem. And it's full of kind of rhymes, information on dialects, word lists of foreign languages, jokes, drawings, preacher's stories. And it's really a description of Europe in the 1530s through people's fashions, foods and money and costumes and weather and local idiosyncrasies. Now, the reason I'm mentioning Baud is because in his Introduction of Knowledge, the conclusion of this text, it's a very long journey, the conclusion is with the Jews. So he's taken the reader on this massive voyage through Europe, and he ends up in Jerusalem, in what he calls the land of Jewry, the land of the Jews, and begins his description of the Jews with the doggerel couplet, I am an Hebrician, some call me a Jew, to Jesu Christ I was never true. And after this preamble, he goes on to repeat a number of what we might think of as medieval accusations against the Jews about their faithlessness to Christ, about their disbelief in the prophets, about their insincerity. But then he goes on to say how few Jews actually live in the land of Jewry in Jerusalem in the present times, in the time he was writing, and instead talks about the Christian pilgrim's route to Jerusalem and the Holy Sepulchre. And we immediately see this slippage between the Jews and their uses to Christians, exactly this kind of past, present and future whirlpool that we've already heard about. And Baud's whole book ends with a list of first the Hebrew alphabet, the Aleph Bet, and then a kind of short phrase list of English to Hebrew. So Baud says, the Hebrew which Jews doth speak now, these days, doth alter from that true Hebrew tongue, except the Jews be clerks, unless the Jews are clerks, just as barbarous Latin doth alter from true Latins, as I have known the truth when I did dwell amongst them Jews. So Baud claims to have learnt Hebrew from Jews he lived with, not in the land of Jewry, but in Europe. And he gives a list of phrases in English translated from Hebrew. I'll give you a few examples. So he says, Godspeed, Godspeed, sir, Hoska, Hoska, Adonai. Ye be welcome, master, Baruch haba, rabbi. Maid, give me drink, Betela, tenli mashke. Woman, give me bread, Nekeva, tenli halechem. Jesus of Nazareth, King of Jews, Yezuk Nazori, Melech Yehudim, the Son of God, have mercy on me, Amen. Ben Elohim, Konveni, Amen. Now, if you do speak Hebrew, you'll have recognized a few words there, but not all of them. If you don't speak Hebrew, I'll say Baud's Hebrew is pretty messed up, but not altogether wrong. And he says it's perfect Hebrew. That's the word he uses, perfect. And he says it's similar to the difference between true Latin and barbarous Latin, a kind of concern with vernacular versus clerical speech. But this is clearly a Christian Hebrew. And that last example, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, Son of God, have mercy on me, Amen, then translated into Hebrew, is clearly a Christian, a take on Hebrew. And here we glimpse a really fascinating element, perhaps the main element of how the Christian Reformation interacted with the Jews, not through anti-Judaism, not through violence, not through Inquisition, but through the Hebrew language and Christian Hebraism, and indeed through printing, which was a key zone of productive, if ambiguous, encounters between Christians and Jews. If you want to know more about Baud, this isn't really the place to go into details, but he was famous also for writing a tract about his beard and how badly it smelt. But he actually had a very sad end. He moved to Winchester and he was charged with keeping prostitutes and put in prison and died in the Fleet in 1549. But Baud was really at the center of the English Reformation, partly through his proximity to Henry VIII, and partly through his life cycle of being from an English monk to an international student to a cultural magpie to a self-described wit, and through his abiding interest in Jews. And language, books, the pursuit of the Hebrew tongue, the key as a key to understanding the true meaning of the Bible, were absolutely central concerns to so many people throughout Europe in the period from the late 15th century to the 17th century, as Kenneth shows. Baud was right on trend. And there's a point where Kenneth describes in his book how in the period between 1512 and I think 1530, chairs of Hebrew were springing up at European universities all over the place, some of them held by Jewish converts to Christianity, and some of them held by Christians, leading to a rapid rise in the availability of formal training in Hebrew, something that had been extremely unusual and contentious in the medieval period. And this emphasis on Hebrew led to some very strange situations in which converted Jews who knew Hebrew could be more zealous anti-Jews than Christian Hebraists. And this is another really valuable issue prompted by Kenneth's book. It's not about Christian versus Jew, but about various gray zones of identity, different kinds of Christians, Protestants, Lutherans, Calvinists, Catholics, Jews, converted Jews, and many other identities. So I'll finish by raising a couple of questions and points for discussion. We're often taught that the Reformation was the battle between a clerical religion, Catholicism, led by priests who spoke Latin, versus a congregational religion, Protestantism, and specifically those more radical, leveling kinds of Protestantism, in which the divine was in the community and the community was the was Holy Church. But a very brief account of someone like Andrew Boord, and there's many other people like him all over Europe, suggests that lots of the European Reformation was conducted via individuals, thinkers, writers, translators, preachers, kings, rather than communities. On the other hand, we often think about medieval anti-Judaism in terms of the mob, cruel communities that mercilessly, if thoughtlessly, massacred the Jews living amongst them. So I suppose my question is whether we should see the Reformation as a history of ideas or a history of communities or both, and how we reconcile that. Is the Reformation about educated men and their books or about people and their congregations? My other question is a much bigger one and one I hesitate to raise, which is about the kind of history of toleration and intolerance. So many of the things we associate with darker moments in European history are themselves inventions of the Reformation or Counter-Reformation period, as Kenneth covers in his book. So the Inquisition, the definition of witchcraft, torture, the ghetto, the declaration of the Talmud as blasphemous. These aren't medieval things, these are Reformation, early modern things. And yet, as Kenneth concludes in his book, by about 1700, the Jews of Europe were in a very different, more optimistic position from where they'd been 100 or 150 years earlier, as most of Europe, apart from Spain, became more welcoming in one way or another towards them. And this leads on to my kind of final point there about kind of plural reformations and plural anti-Judaisms. They are many and various, but can we talk about them in kind of European terms? The Reformation is a European story or a Western European story, and often anti-Semitism is thought of as a European story. So should we be thinking more about the construction of Europe or Europeanness sorry, my screen is just... has just disappeared. There we are. Sorry. Should we be thinking more about the construction of Europeanness or Western Europeanness as the key to understanding the past between Christians and Jews? As Helen asked, what do Jews tell Christians about themselves? Is that a consistent European question that kind of is one of the defining questions of Europeanness? And this is a very good corrective, I think, for me, because I often think of Anglo-Jewish history as being distinctive or unusual. This story of the expulsion in 1290 and the readmission in the 17th century as being a distinctively English trajectory. But Kenneth's book puts these things into a much bigger and much more nuanced framework. So I'll stop there and thank Kenneth for his wonderful book and recommend it to you all and look forward to discussing it with you.
Thank you, Helen and Anthony. And I'm just going to hand back to Kenneth with thanks from me also for his wonderful book. And I think he's going to wrap us up and then we'll lead into the chat. So if you have questions or comments, I will read them out. Do put them in the chat because we will have time to talk more and more with a wider number of people about this. So Kenneth, handing back to you.
Thanks, Sue, and thanks to Helen and Anthony, for being quite so kind. I appreciate that the format of this certainly necessitates you. Character assassination sort of would look mean, so it's, but sort of it's nice of you to say such nice things about the book and to have, I think, sort of done such a good job of picking up things that I was trying to do, but sort of really pushing me in terms of the themes that I talk about. I think there's an inevitability to this, that actually starting to sort of think about this book once it's actually sort of existed in existence, I think then has actually then encouraged me to sort of think a bit more. So what next? And sort of there's an element sort of there's probably sort of some of the discussions sort of so far that make me think, oh, I could go back and do that a bit differently, or now I know what I do now, sort of having written the book, I would write it differently, sort of starting again. But I think sort of, yeah, I'm not sure whether, because I want to sort of leave time for our audience to ask questions, whether I can do justice to the various different questions that you've both raised, but I think there's a lot there. There's an element sort of how, yeah, so Helen's first question about sort of how do they reconcile, sort of how do Christians reconcile what they're hearing in terms of polemic with their lived experience? And I think there's an element then as well, to some extent, perhaps with Anthony's question about sort of ideas and communities and so on, sort of how do ideas interact? And indeed, sort of taking us to the bigger question, sort of what was the Reformation? And I think sort of there, I think it almost gets to the sort of the absolute essence of the question in the first instance. My interest, as I kind of started by saying, has been probably starts from the histories of ideas, the histories of leading thinkers, and sort of my first book on an individual and sort of what he did is probably where I instinctively start from. But I think there is, and I suppose it's still something that we need to work on, but a history of ideas that doesn't just treat ideas in a vacuum. And I think there's sort of, to some extent, and sort of a lot of what I'm perhaps trying to do is to bridge that gap. And I think many do that, of course, but there is that sort of, how do ideas actually make a difference? Are they just, and I think sort of actually the sort of the question of toleration is a perfect example of this, that a lot of the recent scholarship that sort of really distinguishes the idea of toleration from the experience of toleration. And to say, well, these are, you know, some of the recent scholarship tries to pull those apart, say there's two entirely different types of history, different sort of questions that we're asking. To some extent, for me, that goes too far. I think that sort of disambiguation, that separating out, is really helpful to say that sort of when we talk about toleration or sort of ideas, that sort of to some extent there is a heritage. Intellectuals or reformers and so on are reading the works of their predecessors. They're having a discussion amongst themselves, which most people probably don't really engage in fully. They don't necessarily care much about the sort of the finer points of. But that's not the same as then saying that those ideas are happening in a vacuum. And actually sort of, it's then, why do, you know, in the Reformation, why do people kill? Why are they willing to be killed for what they believe in, whether Christian or Jew, whether Protestant or Catholic, and so on. And sort of those ideas do have a kind of a trickle down sort of quality to them, but there is a sort of, I think, a real perhaps selectivity to that process as well, that sort of people are seeing these ideas resonate with me for particular reasons, these ones don't. And kind of finding, I mean, again, this is sort of, Helen alluded to this right at the outset, a lot of that is perhaps the matter of sources. It is easy to write the history of what have Christians said about Jews by just looking at those writings. It is equally sort of to look at the history of toleration by looking at what Erasmus and sort of others of that ilk write about toleration. But then looking at how does this impact on society means looking at court records, more sort of regional documentation, sort of a lot of these sorts of sorts of issues. And actually, sort of, those stories do interconnect, but it's sort of, but they're not answering the same sorts of questions, and sort of drawing the two together, I think, is really difficult. I mean, I think there is, and again, sort of to go to Helen's question about sort of how are these two things reconciled? I think there's one of the strands, or I think sort of one of the arguments that I would make here is that people do seem to be able to make sort of quite sort of nuanced decisions in their own minds. So there might be a, I don't like this type of person, and whether that's religiously defined or whatever as a sort of group, but then on the sort of a day-to-day basis, but the person I live next door to, or sort of that I buy my bread from or whatever is fine. And I think there is a sort of, and a kind of almost a sort of a readiness to make that distinction that sort of indicates that there is a an acceptance of some of the rhetoric, the type, the framing of that, but also perhaps a more human dimension. And I suppose, I mean, I guess as I said at the outset, that sort of at least part of what I've, part of what's drawn me into many of these questions is that interest in sometimes toleration, sometimes ironicism, the more positive dimensions. I think sort of whether or not that comes through in the book, and I think I was keen not to sort of play sort of too positive a take on it. I don't want to sort of play down the sort of the negative sides, but to kind of say again that there was a complexity to many individuals' views and communities' views as well. I think to maybe just to sort of pick up on one or two of the other questions, what Jews, whether Jews were feared because of what they told Christians about themselves, I think was the sort of the way that that Helen put it, or sort of, and I think sort of there is very much that mirror. I think sort of the Jews constituted for many of these Christian groups, again as a sort of as a chosen people, as sort of so interconnected to what it was to be a Christian, but also then sort of in competition. And I think that sort of in many ways is one of the real distinguishing qualities. I mean, I mentioned that sort of one often thinks about sort of different minority groups, and those might be religiously different, but socially different, witches, foreigners as well in this period. And each of, there is that kind of parallelism to Christian expressions and ways of conceptualizing these other groups that sort of say much of that language is a product of a Christian mentality as much as it is about the group that is on the receiving end, as it were. But each of those groups then also has its distinctive sort of components. And I think for Jews in this period, it is that sort of really ambivalent relationship that sort of these are potential collaborators, these are people that we can work with, these are people that are helpful in various ways. Some see this religious boundary as more of an obstacle than others, and of course sort of while some people are ready to go to war or to engage in polemic, many others sort of think this is awful. So why are we as Christians turning against each other? Why are we turning against these? We're all humans, and I think sort of that sort of there is almost a sort of an existential crisis in this world about sort of what is it to be Christian for these Christian groups? What is it to be human? And some of that is, and I think a lot of the work that's been, good work that's been done on the history of toleration is trying to sort of explain how much of this behavior is rational within certain limits. I mean, Helen's alluded to the sort of the difficulties of teaching Reformation history, and is one of the things that I find sort of quite difficult. How do you explain to first year undergraduates why the Reformation mattered, why people sort of cared about the things that they did? And how do you sort of get into that mindset, which in many ways feels so alien to us? But it's to try and sort of say, well, if you believe X and Y, and it's those things are really important to you, then doing X, sort of Z as a consequence becomes more understandable. Not necessarily justifiable, but sort of one can understand, and that's kind of that sort of shift into the mindset. And I think sort of the Reformation sort of is that kind of existential convulsion across the continent, sort of just again, periodic perhaps in the history of Christianity, but sort of how do we make sure that we are good Christians individually? How do we ensure that we're providing sort of that we're making a good Christian community as a whole? But perhaps I should pause there, because sort of I could sort of keep going. There are many more questions, and sort of either Helen and Anthony sort of come back with further questions, or we pick up some from the chat. But I don't want to just speak ad nauseum.
Thank you so much for those great talks. That was completely interesting, and did a lot actually to take the book in many different directions that I think we're all going to want to go in. If it's okay with the speakers, I'll take a couple of questions from the questions, just so we make sure that we have time to let our audience begin. And I'm going to ask our speakers to respond to them. And I'm going to begin actually with the second question, because I think it kind of carries on a little bit from where you were at the end, Kenneth. So what, if anything, did Reformation thinkers or writers make of the period's Jewish Messiah claimants? Ashulamian, David Rubini, Solomon Moloko, and Sabbatai Zevi. I might be saying these wrong, I hope not, but that one might be too late. And I know that, of course, in one of the chapters we read, you rather wonderfully start with the problems of being a Jewish Messiah claimant and how it's a terrible cultural double bind. It was fascinating. So I thought maybe, Kenneth, you'd like to start us off just with a few thoughts about that, then leading into some more thinking, because it brings up the whole question, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be Christian? And what does it mean to be in a community that you're about to diss by claiming to be an even more important part of it, I think?
Yeah.
So I'll just try and shut up. Go for it, Kenneth.
Well, I think there is, yeah, I think sort of to say there is, as with virtually all of these things, there are sort of quite mixed views. So sort of from the Christian side, many people sort of think these are simply charlatans that are turning up, and I mean, again, that's the sort of the standard response to anybody claiming to be anything. Most people will go, no, he clearly wasn't, sort of whatever sort of role is being claimed. But there are some that take it sort of quite seriously, and again, this sort of plays into sort of Reformation sort of power politics to some extent. Some of these sort of are welcomed by both church and state leaders at times, and sort of there is a real sort of interest and enthusiasm, and sort of not all of these claims are dismissed sort of quite so rapidly. So there, I mean, I think there, you know, this is a sort of a period in which again, and sort of it's particular, I suppose, peaks and troughs perhaps of heightened expectations, so sort of that sort of what Christians and Jews are expecting is sort of different, but sometimes sort of to some extent sort of parallel. But there is a kind of, they're looking around and sort of the division of Europe into sort of multiple sort of competing religious groupings, the threat of the Ottomans from the East, the discovery of the New World, from at least the Protestant sort of perspective, the belief that the papacy is now inhabited by Antichrist, all of these things, and sort of and waves of plague and disease and so on, as poor harvest, all interpreted as saying something major is happening, and we don't know quite what it is, but sort of some people have their own particular explanation sort of in mind. But there is a kind of, these many signs suggest that we might be moving into a next phase. When's it going to happen? How's it going to happen? So there is a kind of, even if you might say, well, that's not what we were expecting, these ideas are not necessarily immediately dismissed. And And I think there is that kind of sense that they're sort of feeding off each other as well. So there is that great wide interest.
Would any of our other speakers want to chip in on the messianic?
Can I ask a kind of follow-up question to Kenneth in a way, which is the impression I had is also that the messianism could cause political problems. So popes, theologians might be more receptive towards it, but emperors, kings, princes might be more disruptive in a temporal way. Is that also one of the things which then fractures with the Reformation, would you say, that authority itself becomes more splintered and where authority resides? And then that has a bearing on, because in my period, kind of doing something to your Jews is a kind of exemplary display of power and rule, whereas it seems to become a lot more messy, particularly in the, around issues around, say, messianism or something like that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think sort of there is that increasing sense of who's in charge. I think you're right that sort of immediately and then what place does religion have in this? So the sort of one of the sort of the big sort of grand narrative explanations or sort of arguments that is often used about in relation to the Reformation era is one of confessionalization. That idea that sort of increasingly religion and state sort of merge together, and that the state adopts that kind of a particular religious perspective. And so Spain increasingly comes to be identified as Catholic, England as Protestant, and so on and so forth. And that sort of a means by which perhaps secular powers seek to capitalize on religious authority. But sort of within that, there's then a sort of an extent to kind of say, well, actually, is the church beholden to the state? That sort of, is it now doing the secular power's bidding? And so there's a kind of an effort to shape power, sometimes to break out from within that kind of structure. So I think there is also, and I guess there's the question, sort of the extent to which religious leaders, I want to believe, are generally motivated principally by religious reasons, though of course one doesn't want to be naive on that, but the maintenance of power as a sort of a secular ruler's position means that they may be rather more flexible in sort of what role religion has to play, and sort of, and I think sort of one of the issues, and particularly with some of the messianic figures that emerge, and some of the people that sort of that gain notoriety again, actually, in sort of Christian and Jewish sides, is that once they start to gain followers, how do you actually keep them under control? Do you bring them inside the tent, or do you seek to eliminate them? And I think that sometimes can be a sort of a judgment call there about sort of actually sort of how big a threat do we think this is? Not least because, again, sort of also some of these figures, there are sort of suggestions often that they have a network that extends sort of beyond what we can see here. This is a sort of representative, but he says he's here from the kingdom of wherever, and they might send in an army to sort of deal with it. So we maybe need to sort of check how big a threat that is before we decide exactly. There is that again, it's sort of that sense, who the connections are, who the networks take you to.
Actually, that is a great point to move to another question from the chat, which I also think brings up Helen's question about how should we look at the Reformation. So one of the things that I thought was completely great about your book, I'm sorry that I like it. I agree that it's a liking your book sort of occasion, but I wouldn't have asked you to come if I hadn't. So I'm afraid I can't be, I just have to agree that I do like it. I think it's great. And one of the things I thought it did really wonderfully was sort of reposition everything a bit by decentering Luther, but also by really powerfully changing the historiography, I think, which has, I feel, well, that's another set of questions that I will ask if I get to ask my question. But Helen raised the question, should we rethink the way we think about it as the Reformation, as a time of inverted commas progress? Is that it is a problem. And we also have a wonderful question in the chat, which brings together communities and ideas together around that historiography, I think. In what ways did Jewish entrepreneurs facilitate the Reformation, such as printing religious texts and transporting them? And I think that is a great question, bringing up both how we think about the Reformation and literally how ideas and communities intersect and what the Jewish entrepreneurs were involved in doing it. So I think maybe we'd start this one with Helen and then move on to a couple of others. So would you be happy to start us off on this one, Helen?
Yeah, in a slightly sort of thinking aloud kind of way, the question about the relationship between Jews in early modern Europe and the book trade, I think is an interesting one. It's not something I've worked on myself in a lot of detail, but I think the relatively early adoption of the printing technologies, printing with movable type, within early modern Jewish communities is one of these areas where you can see the impact working in both directions. So it's both impacting on Jewish culture, and the production, mass production of the printed word is an essential part of that. But it's also, if my recollection from the secondary literature is correct, it's also often billed as an illustration of the way in which Jewish and Christian culture started to interact a bit more. And we've spoken quite a lot about, I suppose, what's going on in Northern and Western Protestant Europe. But if we look at the early modern Italian book trade, we can see what are essentially print shops run and owned by Italian Christians, Italian Catholics, but where the means of the production is a much more collaborative endeavor involving Christians and Jews. So you see, I suppose, typesetters and printers involved in the editing and in the control the censorship of Hebrew texts, while at the same time also actively engaging with the people who are producing them as sort of co-adopters of that kind of technology. In the German context, my recollection is that the German Jewish printers were again sort of early adopters of the new technology, but they had a much harder job trying to earn money from the trade and trying to promote themselves during a period of the kind of doctrinal religious conflict that we've been talking about, and also some of those sort of political dislocations. We can see an expansion of the Jewish book trade, but I'm not sure that we see it on quite the same scale. What I don't know, and maybe I just need to drop Kenneth in it at this point, is whether those Jewish printers are in any sense responsible for the production and the dissemination of some of the polemical rhetoric and print media that comes out from Lutheran, Calvinist and other Protestant reformers. So that's me dodging the bullet slightly.
So I'll step in, and I think the question from the chat is, I think it's a really great one actually. It's not a way that I'd thought of this before. So I think sort of part of what I thought I was doing with the book was trying to sort of put religion back into the Reformation, as it were, sort of put religious explanations into sort of how people thought about Jews in the Reformation era, almost responding, because I think sort of the classic argument sort of probably says there's sort of more or gives more attention to socioeconomic reasons that sort of Jews welcomed back into sort of various places, for instance, because of the economic roles that they might do. And so there is a sort of, and I want to say, well, actually sort of there's quite a lot of thinking that needs to take place. This sort of this maybe reflects 20th, 21st century mindset that you just make a decision for economic reasons and put religious questions to one side. Actually, you need to sort of think this through. Am I okay with this? Do I accept this as a position? So I think sort of part of what I was wanting to do was to try and sort of argue for, not for religion over those other factors, but to bring it back into the equation. But actually, I think the way this question has been formulated sort of maybe sort of gives a more nuanced perspective on it than I did, sort of actually to sort of to appreciate that sort of there is at least that possibility. And I think sort of perhaps people in the book trade particularly is a sort of good example of that sort of, but possibly actually again, and I'm trying to sort of think that again, sort of Jews in a whole lot of places. I mean, again, there is a sort of that sort of they even sort of Christian dominated cities in particular. There is a quite a rapid acknowledgement that Jews play a critical role. And I think, again, that's part of the existential sort of difficulty they have. And sort of how can we say that we are good Christians when we're permitting Jews who shouldn't be here anymore? And sort of then sort of tie themselves up in knots, trying to find a way of doing that. But there's a kind of and sort of perhaps to sort of present a sort of a good Christian face, but then actually going, but fine, actually come and we need to do business with you in a lot of ways. And actually sort of, again, sort of, I'm not sure whether it's hypocrisy or what, but there's sort of, again, that sort of trying to sort of reconcile these sort of two different sort of tensions, pushing sort of pulling in different sort of different ways. I don't think, I mean, when it comes back to what Jewish printers would publish, I'm pretty sure they would not publish, well, certainly any anti-Jewish material. Whether they might sort of, I guess, being sort of ready to be involved in Catholic printers sort of publishing anti-Protestant and vice versa, I could certainly see that. I think, again, probably not their sort of areas of particular expertise, and sort of wouldn't necessarily be doing it as Jewish publisher, but to I would probably need to sort of go back to sort of Andrew Pettigrew and sort of in St. Andrews and sort of is that endless sort of book catalogue, all sort of books published across Europe to see exactly who might be publishing. There might be some exceptions, but I think the broader point I absolutely take. There was also the question about the Reformation as progress that sort of I think Sue was trying to sort of get us to sort of back to think about that was one of the ones I failed to pick up on earlier. And I think that's also, I think sort of, it's a really good question. I think sort of when I started off writing this book, I think I was kind of waiting to, you know, sort of, I had a sort of broad, these are the questions I want to look at, but I'm not quite sure where it's going. Probably in the back of my mind, I had this sort of idea that the Reformation was going to be this sort of great turning point. And there would be sort of, this is what the Reformation made different. And I think that's there. But in some ways, I think I ended up sort of coming back to thinking, actually the Reformation is more about rethinking existing questions, sometimes using very familiar, very traditional answers, sometimes because of circumstances coming up with new ways of interpreting it. But there isn't sort of that necessarily that sort of big swoop, that big change. I think that kind of idea of progress is one that I think sort of historians are now sort of very skeptical about. And sort of there's sort of, and almost to the, up to my mind, there's almost been a sort of, I almost want to sort of start swinging things back again. There's a kind of, the it's a difficult one because I think sort of, obviously, I think there's sort of, the classic sort of narrative has, everything gets better up to the present day, sort of Whiggish interpretation of improvement and manifestly sort of attitudes towards treatment of Jews is one of the very clear ways in which that narrative is difficult to sort of maintain from the 20th century. But even across the early modern period, the 16th and 17th centuries, there's been almost a kind of say, well, there is no change, or it kind of feels like we've almost reached a point where there's no change between 1500 and 1700. And I think it's sort of, I think there's sort of the same points are being made in 1500 and in 1700. But I think there is a sort of a shift in the balance that sort of has that kind of everything's always the same sort of perhaps neglects. So I think there's maybe hints of progress, but it's not sort of, not, I don't know, sort of, I think I'm seeing Helen nodding in agreement with that. But
yeah, It's another nail in the coffin of the argument that the late medieval church calls the Reformation, which calls the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, which calls modernity and toleration. And actually, the end point is inaccurately defined, never mind the trajectory by which we get there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm afraid that by our rules, I'm just brimming with things that I want to ask now. I want to ask about Borromeo. I want to ask about insider history and how much that has shaped. But I mustn't, because there are questions in the chat that I still haven't even come to. So I just want to say thank you so much to all our participants and to our audience for joining us in our boxes this evening together. And thank you so much. I'm going to bring this to an end, and I'd be really happy for anybody to, before you leave, clap in any riotous way you would like to clap. So I'm going to make a horrible noise. So thank you very much for tremendous talks.
Thanks all for coming.